Welcome to Metro Connection. I'm Rebecca Shear, and this week, we're breaking the mold. Now, mind you, we'd kind of like to think that's what we're doing every week, but with our captivating, sound-rich storytelling and all, but this time around, we're breaking the mold in an even more explicit and humble way by making it our show theme and devoting the next hour to people and things across the DC region that are truly going against the grain. Like the local video store that managed to hold out against the big boys far longer than most.
One of the greatest things about growing up was always going to the video store with your parents to pick out a movie. It was part of the American experience. Now, younger people won't be able to do that.
And the bus driver who doesn't just give commuters a lift, he lifts up their spirits.
You never know what you might say to them might spark them.
We'll also meet some rabble-rousing writers from the 19th century.
These are the romantic poets. They're incredible.
But before we get to all that, you know the saying, beauty is in the eye of the beholder? Well, in the case of our first story, beauty isn't so much in the eye as in the ear.
What was interesting about kind of removing the visual context from a lot of these pieces is that you can enjoy them and in some cases get completely lost in a sound and you would have no idea what it is that you're hearing.
This is Ryan Holiday.
I am the new media curator here at Artisphere.
That's the nearly four-year-old art center located just a hop, skip, and jump from the Rosslyn Metro Station.
And along with my brother Hayes and Cynthia Connolly, the visual arts curator, we have put together Fermata, a celebration of sound.
Ryan and I are in one of Artisphere's three galleries where, now through August 10th, guests can come and see Fermata. Or wait, see Fermata? No, wait, that wouldn't be right. When you talk about people coming here, are you saying when people see the exhibit? Like, what language are you using when you talk about visitors coming?
That's a good question. I don't know. Language fails us at every turn here when it comes to sound, doesn't it?
In a way, it kind of does. I mean, even the word exhibit has visual connotations. It suggests a display, which the Merriam-Webster Dictionary defines as a setting or presentation of something in open view. Not that Fermata is devoid of things to view. Inside the spacious gallery, you'll find a handful of leather couches, a sprinkling of red and brown beanbag chairs, which actually is where Ryan and I decided to conduct our interview.
How many interviews do I get to start by saying, where should we start? I don't know, sit in the beanbag.
And then the sounds in the show emanate from a physical and literal wall of sound. Dozens of different sized speakers mounted in a grid-like pattern on one of the bright white walls.
Everyone in the show has the ability to have 14 channels of audio. So these are distinct channels that are kind of mapped throughout the speaker grid that every contributor had access to.
The nearly 30 contributors hail from the world over. Australia, Japan, Macedonia, England, Switzerland, Germany, France, Spain. Some are composers, some are field recordists, at least one is a scientist. Some keep things simple by using just one or two channels on the speaker grid. But others, like Canadian artist CFCF, go a little bit wild.
He had this work that was inspired by Philip Glass and actually Ryuichi Sakamoto, who's also in the show, that is really just this kaleidoscopic work that kind of builds throughout the whole thing. But the way he did it was he sort of deconstructed this piece that he had composed and then reimagined it for this space and for the speaker wall. So you'll be standing in one place and you'll hear a piano start on, say, the other side of the room. And then trumpets come in next to you. And then all these different sounds start to sort of activate the room in a way that really would only be possible with a setup like this.
Other contributors looked at the speaker grid as a kind of map. Like Lucianne Walkowitz, who works on NASA's Kepler mission and uses the telescope's light readings to study star spots and stellar flares.
So the way that this worked a lot of the time was I created this diagram of what the speaker wall would look like and just shared it with potential contributors and said, what would you do with this speaker matrix? And Lucianne got back to me right away and said, here's exactly how I would do it. She showed me this map of how Kepler looks at the sky.
And she took that map of Kepler's view of the sky and superimposed it on top of Ryan's speaker grid.
So she took light readings and turned them into audio. And then actually placed them within the speaker wall relative to where they were in the sky. So she's really using this layout that we have as a sonic manifestation of how Kepler sees space.
So, as you can see, I did it again. As you can hear, the sounds Fermata offers really do run the gamut. CFCF's piece Glass is more of a musical composition, or decomposition, I guess. Lucianne Walkowitz's Stellar Tathata uses sounds from space. Then there's Machine Room DPA March 31 by the London Sound Survey.
It's actually this beautiful kind of ambient tone drone. But what it is, it's the sound of the gears and the engine room inside of London Bridge. So this is the sound of the bridge opening, which is kind of cool because this is a place that is not open to the public. So you're actually hearing something that you wouldn't be able to hear.
It's this wide variety of sounds that inspired Ryan and his fellow curators to name the show Fermata. See, in musical notation, a fermata is the mark you place above a note or a rest on the staff.
And it indicates to the conductor or to the player that they can sustain that note for longer than the note value indicates. And so we sort of took that idea and applied it to sound in general and said, this show is an invitation to sort of suspend your preconceived notions of how you come to sound. It's an invitation to the visitor to expand their definition of sound. Yeah, am I saying the same thing again?
You're putting a fermata over it.
Yeah. Right. Sustaining this answer is what I'm doing.
Fermata will unfold in three parts, or movements as they're called. You can hear the first loop of pieces through May 25th, the second through June 22nd, and the third through July 20th. The last part, titled Coda, will run through August 10th and feature works by emerging local artists under the guidance of Ryan Holiday and other mentors. So, all in all, Fermata will include roughly 30 pieces of all kinds of sound from all across the planet, and thanks to Lucianne Walkowitz, beyond.
Has anything like this ever been done in the region?
I don't think on this scale and with this many contributors. We're confident that it's the largest sound exhibition that's happened in the D.C. area to date.
Kind of breaking the mold.
Yeah, but again, a visual analogy, right? We need something that's sound.
You can check out the first movement of Fermata at Artisphere right now. And if you'd like a sneak peek, or sneak here, I don't know, we have samples of some of the pieces in the show on our website, metroconnection.org. We move now from audio technology to the more nuts and boltsy computer stuff. Computer programming, in fact. If we look at Silicon Valley, which pretty much dominates the world in all things tech, last year more than 90% of startup founders were men. 82% were white. And that's pretty representative of technology as a whole. But the new DC-based nonprofit called Code for Progress is trying to change that. Folks there are working with a rich cross-section of people traditionally left out of the tech world, like women, minorities, and people with disabilities, and teaching them how to code. Lauren Ober sat in on a class to see how the new face of tech looks.
If the world is divided into two distinct camps, digital natives and digital immigrants, Terry Acker is most definitely a member of the latter. The grandmother of seven came of age when the only phones available had cords and a finger wheel. High-tech meant a television that had color or a radio that could fit in your pocket. So it's kind of a big deal that at 51, Acker is learning to code every day from 9 to 5.
Classes have been going pretty good. It's not as easy as I thought, but it's good.
Acker, who lives in Anacostia, is a fellow at Code for Progress, which is teaching people who have traditionally been overlooked by the tech community how to write computer code. And basically, the folks who have been excluded are everyone but white men. Latinos, people of color, disabled people, seniors, LGBT people. The list goes on. Michelle Fox is the managing director at Code for Progress. This is the first year for the initiative, which is the brainchild of activist Dirk Wiggins. With his flat cap and waxed handlebar mustache, Wiggins looks the part of tech geek. But Fox says Wiggins recognized that everyone else in the field pretty much looked like him as well.
We're leaving a lot of talent on the table. We're leaving a lot of possibilities on the table because we're not bringing in people from different backgrounds, different life experiences who might be able to inform the work in a really different way.
And that's kind of a problem Because
what we've heard from a lot of the folks who applied to the program is that they never thought that they could be a coder.
So by recruiting diverse participants, Code for Progress is trying to introduce new ideas to the tech sector. It's a subtle form of activism, which makes sense since social justice is a huge part of the organization's mission. The program works like this. For 3 months, a dozen fellows take intensive coding classes and then get paired up with community nonprofits to help create technology for them. After their residency, the learning continues with mentorships and career counseling. Bobby Joe Smith III is one of the fellows.
I really get excited every day to come into the program because I know that I'm going to come away with one more piece to being able to build the app that I want to build.
Smith is Lakota and a member of the Cheyenne Sioux River tribe. He spent part of his childhood on the Standing Rock Indian Reservation in North Dakota. Before arriving in D.C., his tech experience was limited.
I took a computer science course at Middlebury College, and which did not go very well, to be honest.
But that didn't put him off tech. He had bigger ambitions than just getting a good grade.
Part of what interested me in this program is I started seeing Native communities using tech to help organize around issues that they care about, whether that's bringing our culture online to be able to share across the country, no matter where Native people are, to movements like the Idle No More movement in Canada, and gaining support online through organizing in that manner.
Smith and his classmate Terry Acker are both full of ideas about the apps they want to develop. But first, they have to get through coding class.
First things first, y'all.
Alia Rahman is the lead instructor for the program. She's a coder, an organizer, and the kind of teacher any adult learner would love to have. She's patient, funny, and perhaps most importantly, she's respectful of her students' differences.
All right, quick review, and the way that I type that with upper and lowercase stuff is called what?
Camel case.
We get in there. We had camel back earlier. We had camel cat.
Yeah, camel case. We're getting there.
Dromedary.
The fellows are in the beginning stages of learning the programming language Python. Rahman starts the lesson with an analogy.
Here's a question for you. In a movie, in TV, in a play, what is a script? Who's ever been in a play? That includes if you were like 7, it's fine. Me too, I was in Mary Poppins. I was a nanny, which is kind of weird. So what did you use scripts for?
They go on to discuss how a script in Python acts just like a script in a movie. Okay. It provides a set of directions. Everyone in the class gets it. Rahman's techniques win high praise from students like Terry Acker.
She makes it plain for us. I mean, we even had a lesson where she was like, okay, this is like we're putting together a peanut butter jelly sandwich, you know, because that's what coding is like. You fit the pieces together, and it made it all come home.
And knowing how to fit all the pieces together in tech makes all the difference. I'm Lauren Ober.
After the break, we'll go from mold breaking to ground breaking as we visit a project that could transform the Anacostia River.
In total length, the tunnel will be 13 miles long.
Stick around, that and more is coming your way on Metro Connection here on WAMU 88.5.
WAMU news coverage of labor and employment issues is made possible by your contributions and by Matthew Watson, in memory of Marjorie Watson. And support for WAMU 88.5's coverage of the environment comes from the Wallace Genetic Foundation, dedicated to the promotion of farmland preservation, the reduction of environmental toxins, and the conservation of natural resources.
I'm Rebecca Shear, and welcome back to Metro Connection. Today, we are breaking the mold, paying tribute to those pioneers among us, people who think outside the box. But when it comes to figuring out a very complex problem, the builders of an 11-mile rail line from D.C. to Reston are having some trouble. And that's the subject of our regular transportation segment, From A to B. A to B. WAMU's transportation reporter Martin DeCaro joins us now to talk about the long-awaited Silver Line Metro Rail through Tyson's Corner, as well as some other news in our transit world. Martin, welcome back to the show.
Well, thanks, Rebecca. Glad to be here.
All right, so the last time we chatted, the Silver Line was experiencing, I guess, some issues, you would call them, and we did not know when it was going to open. So I guess the big question is, has anything changed?
Yes and no. How about that for an answer?
Thanks. Right,
so we're still not sure when you'll be able to ride the train to Tyson's to do your high-end shopping, Rebecca. But we do have an estimated timetable for the project's completion and a list of everything that has to be fixed to get there.
Okay, so first off, I work in public radio, so much for that high-end shopping. But second of all, let's talk about that timetable.
Here's the process, right? The agency overseeing the project, the Airports Authority, has reached an agreement with Metro to complete work on outstanding issues that have delayed the Silver Line's opening, with the hope of handing the project over to Metro this month. Here is Metro General Manager Richard Sarles.
Based on what they've shown us thus far, that sometime towards the latter part of May, they should be able to turn that over to us. We call it ORD, or operational readiness. That allows us to begin our testing.
But it sounds like there's a lot to do before Metro can actually start that testing of the Silver Line.
Yes, and without getting too technical, here's what lies before the Airports Authority and its contractor, Bechtel. The last thing anyone wants to do is open the Silver Line and have service delays.
Hear, hear.
Right, so many of the problems Bechtel and its subcontractor, Alstom Signaling, have to fix involve the Silver Line's automatic train control system. That's a system that keeps trains spaced apart, controls their speeds, prevents collisions, you get the picture. These problems are affecting the reliability of service, meaning they're not safety critical, but they're troublesome nonetheless. For instance, the contractors have to fix what are called bobbing track circuits. And I'll let the project's executive director, Pat Nowakowski, explain what's happening there.
What actually happens is the signal system thinks a track is occupied by a train, when indeed that is not the case. So it stops other trains from going past that point. So operationally, that's a problem when trains are stopping when they do not need to because the track is not occupied.
So the silver lining is, pardon the pun, the fail-safe system.
go ahead.
The fail-safe system is working, except test trains are stopping when they shouldn't.
So it sounds like Metro is going to be taking on an unfinished product.
Yes, and that was not the plan. But given all the problems the contractor has had in any number of areas, Metro and the Airports Authority have come to an arrangement that these issues will be resolved while Metro is ramping up the passenger service. But ultimately, Metro has to see that the system is working reliably enough to open it, and we won't know if that is the case for a few more weeks, possibly more.
Okay, so a lot is obviously unknown right now, but can we even guesstimate when the Silver Line might open?
I do not have a precise date for you, but I can guesstimate. Barring any other unforeseen delays, mid to late summer is possible.
All right. So moving from trains to automobiles, I understand Uber is in the news again.
Yep. Uber is the car service you order with your smartphone. It's one of several tech companies that connects people with rides. Vehicles for hire, to be exact. So Uber has a service called UberX. Two other tech startups in D.C., Lyft and Sidecar, offer their own similar services, and they all have one thing in common. When you open their smartphone apps to order a ride, someone driving their own personal vehicle comes to pick you up.
So then what you're saying is it's not a commercially licensed taxi. It's just a person trying to make some extra bucks and using his or her own car to do it?
Yeah, that's pretty much right. The companies like to call it ride sharing, but it's really private livery without a commercial license. And in other cities and states now, Uber has been sued by people injured in crashes caused by UberX drivers because the driver's personal car insurance policy did not cover them. There is a liability insurance gap there. So regulators in D.C. are proposing rules to require these services have enough insurance.
Wait, let me get this straight. You're saying if I step into the back seat of one of these private taxis and I get injured in a crash, I may not be covered by the driver's insurance?
Good question. I asked that very question to the chairman of the D.C. Taxicab Commission, Ron Linton.
We cannot say that today. Hopefully, if we can adopt regulations as we're moving towards, we would hopefully be able to say your credit card is safe, your identity is safe, and if there should be an accident, the liability is covered so that you will have fair recompense.
UberX, Lyft, and Sidecar say the proposed regulations are onerous and that they've already beefed up their own insurance policies. Here's Uber's head of global policy, Corey Owens.
The policies carried by UberX drivers and by Uber as a company not only cover every possible period of time, but they also vastly exceed the insurance carried by DC taxi companies.
So the district has just started dealing with this issue. It's unclear how the final regulations, if any, will shake out. Really, what we're seeing is the clash of innovative, disruptive, if you will, technology companies against the traditional regulated taxicab industry. Consumers do have a lot of choices now, but the changes are raising questions about public safety, at least when it comes to insurance.
Well, let's hope those questions get answered soon. Martin DeCaro, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
We turn now from taxis and trains to another form of transit here in the D.C. region, buses. Metrobus prides itself on providing more than 400,000 trips each weekday and serving more than 11,000 bus stops in D.C., Maryland, and Virginia. The fleet currently boasts about 1,500 buses operating on 325 routes. And one of those routes is driven by a man who's managed to break the mold in a pretty distinctive way. Through the boost of inspiration, he gives his passengers. But as Matthew Schwartz tells us, Derek Perry's message of positivity wasn't that easy in the coming.
It's 7 o'clock on a Friday morning, and sleepy passengers are trickling onto the B8 bus in Northeast Washington. Riders who have never experienced operator Derek Perry before have no idea what's about to happen.
All right, ladies and gentlemen, this year is going to be you all's year. Everybody on this bus is going to be successful. You got to stay focused, though. Stay focused and stay positive.
Perry's not your average bus driver. He's only been operating the bus a couple years, but he already has a bit of a cult following. As the bus fills up, Perry draws on the crowd's energy.
Today is that day we've been waiting all week for you all. All week. You all enjoy. This is our day today.
That's right, bro.
Yeah, you all enjoy it.
That's
Have
right,
a
brother.
safe, good weekend.
Once you've had the operator Perry experience, you're never going to forget it.
Perry's fans come from all walks of life. Take Mark Funkhauser, who got the Perry experience when Perry drove the 43 last year.
I was mayor of Kansas City from May of 2007 to May of 2011. In all my life, I have never seen a bus driver like Operator Perry. I mean, you can have a nice bus driver, you can have a polite bus driver, but how often do you have a bus driver tell you, I love you?
Perry tailors his message to the crowd. This particular morning, he's addressing an audience of students on their way to school.
Kids in school, stay focused in school, y'all. Want to try to go to college? College is unbelievable. You're gonna love it. I guarantee you, you're gonna love it. Got to get them grades up.
Perry never went to college. He gives the students advice he wishes he had followed when he was their age.
You got people around you bringing negativity into your life. You're gonna have to distance yourself from them. Cause misery loves company, and it can bring you down. You gotta stay focused. Yeah, this is gonna be a good day today. Real good day.
Facing negativity is something Operator Perry knows far too much about. It all began, he says, when he was growing up in Southeast D.C. and showing promise as a football player.
A lot of guys from the streets would give me money when I score touchdowns, make good plays, and so I started looking up to the hustlers as a role model. And I wanted to dress like them, beautiful women. I wanted to have them. They have, you know, wads of money. And so that just, it just caught my eye. And one thing led to another thing. I got into the streets selling drugs. I did time.
12 years behind bars when all was said and done. But at age 40, he decided he was tired of what he calls a no-ending road.
I'm not ashamed to say. I'm not ashamed. A lot of people won't even tell you that they used to get high, that they were locked up, that they've been shot. I don't have no problem because I know where I'm at now. And I'm at so much peace. I'm at so much peace now.
Perry believes he was saved for a reason. Now, he says, it's his mission to change other people's lives for the better.
That's why I can get across to the young adults now, because I've been where they are and I can see the struggle that they have in front of them. And when I can tell them where I came from and where I'm at now, it helps out a whole lot when I talk to them. A lot of kids are looking for a lot of love. They are. They are looking for love. So, and you can see it in their face when you start talking about positive things, how their eyes just widen up. And they want that. They want somebody to show that they care. They need that. You can't give up on them. You never know what you might say to them might spark them.
Kids aren't the only ones who find inspiration in Perry's words. Marine biologist David Guggenheim was on Perry's route once on an August trip to the dentist.
You know, there's a difference between someone being courteous and friendly and somebody really exuding warmth from the heart. I think we know the difference when we see it. And he was all in. 8 months later, I'm still feeling it.
Well, thank y'all for riding with me this morning.
Thank you.
You all don't know it, but you all make my mornings every day, and I appreciate it.
As groups of passengers arrive at their destinations, Perry delivers one last message to get them through whatever the day may hold.
Listen to me. If nobody told you they love you this morning, Operator Perry loves you all. And I got y'all.
And for Perry, it's not just idle talk.
It pleases me to see other people happy and to know what I'm doing to them. With this job, I love this job so much. It's almost like I have to pinch myself. It's almost like, do I really get paid for this? They can even pay me half of what I'm getting, and I would still love
it. Don't tell them that.
I'm Matthew Schwartz.
Curious to see Operator Perry in action? We have a video of him on our website, metroconnection.org. We turn now from the road to the river. Or 100 feet below the river, to be precise. Indeed, beneath the Potomac, you'll find a tunnel that could very well change the way D.C. deals with its raw sewage. See, traditionally, whenever a big rainstorm has hit the area, overflows of stormwater and sewage have washed right into the Anacostia and Potomac rivers, not to mention Rock Creek and smaller tributaries. The Anacostia River Tunnel is part of a plan mandated by the Environmental Protection Agency to address that pollution problem. And the folks at DC Water were good enough to let our environment reporter Jonathan Wilson go down into the tunnel to see the progress they're making so far and how the actual digging gets done.
Everything about DC Water's latest tunneling project is big.
You'll see, you might get a little splatter here, but they're gonna dump a box. So
that's James Wanneberg, resident engineer on the project. And as you might have guessed, the box he's talking about is huge, more like a shipping container. Right now, we're still above ground, at the top of a drop shaft that measures 75 feet across and 10 stories down. The box contains some of the mud that gets pulled out of the ground as the tunnel gets longer. In the end, the length will be 13 miles. To get to the tunnel, you head down into that drop shaft. Crew members make the descent in an orange metal cage.
This is what we call the Alamac. It's a elevator that's going to take us down to the bottom of the shaft, and we'll catch the train.
Not much room in here, is there?
No, it's tight, but we can fit.
Intermittent horns and buzzers tell crew members at the bottom of the drop shaft when something is being lifted or lowered by the pulley, and for good reason. The 10-story drop means that even a falling clump of dirt could do serious harm. Turns out many of the crew have worked together before. Ray Hashimi, the assistant resident engineer, came with Wanneberg from another tunneling project in Seattle.
The tunneling industry is a very niche group, so we all go from different, we're like gypsies, we all go from different places to places, and we all know each other.
That includes Jeffrey Jenkins, who says he's been working on underground projects in D.C. since 1988. On this project, he drives the Loki, that's short for locomotive. It's how just about everything, from people to food to the 10-ton concrete slabs that make up the wall of the tunnel, get where they need to be.
Everything they get, I bring to them.
The actual tunnel, 26 feet in diameter, is being created by a giant earth-chewing tunnel boring machine, or TBM. As it digs through the earth, it lays the precast 10-ton concrete blocks that form the walls of the watertight tube.
There's actually been a lot of these lately. In the U.S. right now, there's probably 10 to 15 different tunnels being dug at any given time right now. Around the world, there's hundreds.
So far, the machine, named the Ladybird after President Lyndon Johnson's environmentally minded wife, has tunneled north more than 4,500 feet. It still has a few miles to go before completing what's known as the Blue Plains phase of the tunnel, which is 4.5 miles long.
A second phase of this huge tunnel will start all the way at RFK Stadium and actually come south on the Anacostia.
George Hawkins is DC Water's general manager.
The third phase of the tunnel will start at RFK Stadium and tunnel into the city to where LaDroite Park, Bloomingdale, that historic flooding has happened.
Hawkins says most people who rely on modern water utilities rarely appreciate the engineering muscle and technological prowess required to get clean water to every faucet in a city and keep dirty water out of local waterways. He hopes this project will change that and make people realize that water just might be an underpriced resource.
Our view in this industry is that if we can describe and explain in a way that is meaningful and understandable to the people we serve what their money is going towards. It's our judgment that most of the people we've talked to, not willingly, no one willingly writes out a bill, but at least accepts that this is a good investment because my family, every living organism, whether it's human or otherwise, relies on clean drinking water.
And D.C. water bills have had to go up to pay for the $2.6 billion Clean Rivers Project, which includes not only the cost of the 13-mile Anacostia water tunnel, but also two additional tunnels planned for coming years. In 2009, D.C. Water implemented an impervious area charge for all customers to help pay for the Clean Rivers Project. The more impervious the surface on your property, that would include most buildings or houses, and any blacktop or concrete, the more you're contributing to stormwater runoff and the more you pay. The average charge is an additional $12 each month. The project will remove 98% of the combined sewage and stormwater that flows into the Anacostia River. But Hawkins says there may be an even better and cheaper way to keep our rivers clean.
One of the attributes of the tunnel is it only works when you have a big enough rainstorm to cause the sewers to overflow. Otherwise, it sits empty and is not doing anything at all, even despite the expense.
That's why Hawkins and DC Water have gone back to the EPA with an alternative plan that would create a smaller second tunnel and eliminate the need for a third tunnel altogether, all by investing $60 million in things such as permeable pavement and green roofing to absorb more water runoff. The new plan would save the average customer about $400 a year.
Green infrastructure provides benefits all at every rainstorm. It could be a sprinkling of water, and that will absorb it, and the green will grow, and all those benefits will come.
For now, George Hawkins has to wait and see if the Department of Justice and the EPA find the green infrastructure plan acceptable. In the meantime, says Loki driver Jeffrey Jenkins, the Anacostia water tunnel isn't a bad place to be.
They have it down to art. It's pretty neat.
Art and sewage. A few hours underground with the technology behind the Anacostia water tunnel, and you might start thinking those two things can actually go together. I'm Jonathan Wilson.
So here's the thing. Much as we trust Jonathan, we couldn't send him underground alone. And lucky for us, web producer Martin Ostermuhl took some amazing pictures and video while he was playing chaperone. You can see it all on our website, metroconnection.org. Time for another break, but when we get back, breaking the rules, punk style.
It's so wonderful to find classically based plays that are even more punk than we are.
It's coming your way on this Breaking the Mold edition of Metro Connection. You're on WAMU 88.5. Welcome back to Metro Connection. I'm Rebecca Shear, and this week we are shaking things up and marching to the beat of a different drummer with a show we're calling Breaking the Mold. Earlier in the hour, we heard about Artisphere's latest offering, which suggests that beauty isn't always in the eye of the beholder. Sometimes it's in the ear. And in just a bit, we'll visit an independent retailer in Northwest Washington that managed to buck a major trend and go its own way for years. But first,
all right,
we'll head to Southeast Washington.
Actors, stand by, please.
To the Black Box Theater inside Capitol Hill Arts Workshop, or CHA, not far from Eastern Market. That's where veteran D.C. theater artist Lise Bruneau,
so let me know when the curtain speech must happen,
is leading a dress rehearsal with the company she co-founded 10 years ago. taffety, punk.
We tend to be obsessed with the classics just because of our training and who we are. But anything goes.
And she's not kidding. This, after all, is a theater company that's produced all female versions of Julius Caesar and Titus Andronicus. That's set Shakespeare's poem, The Rape of Lucrece, to live punk music. And that's taken conversations from actual suicide chat rooms on the internet and turned them into a dance piece.
We're not interested in being flip, we are finding ways to take the message of the play even further and have even more fun with it.
And Bruneau and company are having a heck of a lot of fun right now as they gear up for the Rule Breaker Rep, a repertory of two alternating plays. Charm, by Kathleen Cahill, is being directed by Kelsey Mesa, and Bruneau is directing Howard Brenton's Bloody Poetry. Just before the dress rehearsal for the latter, I sat down with Bruneau, who, by the way, is also starring in Charm, and asked her what the Rule Breaker Rep is all about.
It's about writers. It's about poets and free thinkers, forward thinkers, people that are trying to change the world, rule breakers.
Hence the name, Rule Breaker Rep. Bloody Poetry explores the complex relationship among three of the English language's most renowned writers, Lord Byron and Percy and Mary Shelley. Oh, and Mary's half-sister, Claire.
To all accounts, Shelley and Mary Shelley and Mary's half-sister were in a three-way marriage.
What an unholy, holy family. We little band of atheistical perverts. Free lovers. We poeticals. Leaving England.
So you've got the Shelleys knowing the renown of Lord Byron, who is another rule breaker. He hangs out with whores and, you know, like squanders his money, is drunk all the time and makes a, you know, public display of himself, but is a genius poet and is someone that is looking to challenge society's norms. And they're dying to meet each other. Well, Claire, one of the three-way marriage, runs off with Byron, has an affair with him, and then manages to arrange a meeting between everybody. So these two legendary poets will be finally meeting each other, and then they end up spending the summer together in Italy, all four of them.
We are privileged to make this journey. We are privileged to stand on this beach and watch George Byron and Bysshe Shelley meet. It will be history.
And during this time, they, you know, throw down about poetry, morality. It's really wild to be in the room with these four people navigating this impossible, impossible stuff.
And then the other show, Charm.
So Charm is more of a magical treatment of Margaret Fuller's life. She hung out with the Transcendentalists, a very strong feminist that worked with Thoreau and Emerson, Nathaniel Hawthorne. So this sort of pits a very strong thinking woman, a very forward-thinking woman, among men who aren't quite ready to handle it. I think it kind of gives a bad break to these gentlemen in history, because I think they did give her a little more of a break than this writer is making it seem. But my gosh, here is a woman who feels bound by her learning, by her brain and her feistiness, and is dying for a boyfriend. She's basically just wants to get married and have kids, but of course she's a fierce thinker, and no one is able to see her in a sexual way at all. And so the suffering that she goes through with this, and the various people she finds along the way, and then her ultimate trip to Italy, where most of her questions are answered.
Spoiler alert.
Pretty much. I can't tell you what happens, but it's magical and beautiful. And it's the, you know, the sort of thing where certain characters, you know, it just spontaneously starts snowing on them, and certain characters turn into teapots and dresses take over the area of the stage at certain times. So there's a lot of bells and whistles and fun things to play with.
It sounds like a lot of fun in that both plays involve real life characters, but certain liberties are taken with the actual stories.
Yeah, quite. I think less so in Bloody Poetry. Bloody Poetry, a lot of the facts are in order and fascinating. You know, you can't make this stuff up is what one often thinks when you're researching some of these characters.
How much do you think it'll change the audience's experience if they have heard of or know a lot about these real life figures, as opposed to if they're not that familiar with them?
I think it goes both ways. There are a lot of surprises in the sense that, okay, this is the famous summer where all of these writers dared each other to write ghost stories. And Mary Shelley came up with Frankenstein. Well, there are a couple of mentions of that, but it's not really a major part of the play. So you'll notice that and go, ooh, ooh, and get really excited. And then, you know, we'll move on to some of the other more dramatic moments of their lives. So I think that there are lots of hidden treats for people that do know. But if you don't, you get enough information about who they are and how much trouble they caused, how many lawsuits there were, how many times they had to flee, you know, to Italy or Switzerland, that there's plenty to keep everybody busy.
Such rabble rousers.
It's unbelievable. I mean, like I say, you can't make this stuff up. My impression of that period is that, of course, everybody's very uptight. But these folks, I mean, Percy Bysshe Shelley and Mary Shelley were not married. Yeah, they ran off to Italy together with a half-sister. They're all in a kind of three-way marriage. Okay, but nobody's actually married until Shelley's wife, actual wife, drowns herself in like a three-foot-high river. Yeah, and like Mary's other sister, who was like 15, and Shelley was with her for a little while, and then they left her, and she killed herself, I think, with opium. I mean, it's just... These are the romantic poets. They're incredible. So it's so wonderful to find classically based plays that are even more punk than we are. You know, it just, it feels great.
That was Lise Bruneau, co-founder of Taffety Punk Theater Company and director and actor in the Rule Breaker Rep, running May 7th through the 31st at Capitol Hill Arts Workshop. For more on bloody poetry and charm and the company as a whole, visit our website, metroconnection.org. We turn now from live entertainment to entertainment of the small screen variety. In this age of on-demand movies, streaming services, and Netflix, you tend to see fewer and fewer video stores. But here in D.C., one video store held on longer than most. I say held on past tense because after 33 years of business, Potomac Video is finally shutting its doors. And as special correspondent Kavitha Cardoza tells us, customers say they'll miss more than just the movies.
Ted Tharp is gingerly balancing dozens of DVD and VHS tapes as he gets to the register at Northwest DC's Potomac Video.
I'm buying them all. Greatest classics. You can't even get these anymore on any website. These are mostly out of print, and they're great.
Potomac Video has been a neighborhood institution in DC's Chevy Chase Circle for more than 30 years. But now the store is closing down, and everything is for sale. Tharp says it's a huge loss.
One of the greatest things about growing up was always going to the video store with your parents to pick out a movie. It was part of the American experience. Now, younger people won't be able to do that.
There's a stage play version of that.
Oh,
and
I know.
We had three until about like 2 days ago, and I think they all got scooped up.
I'm sure they have.
John Franca bought movies for all these stores, at one point spending more than $1 million a year.
At our peak, we had 22 stores in three different states and the district.
This store carried approximately 60,000 titles and was considered a treasure because you could find everything from the latest blockbuster to obscure documentaries to niche foreign films.
All our foreign titles are divided up by country or language. If someone was really into Israeli film, they could go there and just work their way through, you know, 300 Israeli films. One of our last sections we added was called Great Plays, and it was all the filmed adaptations of Ibsen and, well, actually, we already had a Shakespeare section, but all the great plays that you can think of. And sometimes we'd have four or five different versions of the same play, and that was a very popular section.
Bill Flanders is next in line. He says he's been coming here for what seems a lifetime and has rented lots of movies.
Hundreds. Seriously, hundreds. There aren't many places like this. In fact, there's none left in the district. So it means that I won't be able to come up and look for something for my wife and myself some night. I've lost something.
That sense of loss is seemingly universal here. Kerry Armstrong, another customer, says she's sad the video store is going out of business because it's such an important part of the neighborhood.
Everyone's shut in their house looking at a computer. It's nice to be able to go to a store where you can put your hands on something and talk to people and get advice. It's sort of social.
Eleanor Bedford and her son Ben are regulars.
We have our pizza movie night every Friday.
They have to find a new ritual now. Ben chooses among Scooby-Doo titles stacked higher than him.
I got it. It was one of the original Scooby-Doo's Creepiest Capers.
My son started hyperventilating when he heard the news that his favorite video store was going out of business.
John Franca looks stoic as he rings up Eleanor Bedford and other customers and sees all the movies he's bought over the years leave the store forever. He says it's hard to let go of films he may never see again.
They all have to go, but every once in a while I see one that leaves and I was like, I may never see that movie again. The Garden of the Finzi Contini's, extremely rare DVD.
But Franca understands that people like the ease of watching a movie online. He himself has a subscription to Amazon Prime, and his girlfriend has a Netflix account. I'm Kavita Cardoza.
Want one last glance at Potomac Video? We have a gallery of photos on our website, metroconnection.org. And tell us, do you have special memories of Potomac Video or any other neighborhood video store? Send an email to metro@wamu.org. And special thanks to Andrew Katz-Moses, who contributed to this report. And now, our weekly trip around the region. On today's Door to Door, we visit Lake Barcroft, Virginia, and Fort Washington Estates, Maryland.
My name is Jay Krieger. I'm 52 years old, and I live in the subdivision of Fort Washington Estates in Fort Washington, Maryland. The community is located about 15 miles south of D.C., due south, along the Potomac River, almost directly across from Mount Vernon and adjoining Fort Washington National Park. Predominantly, I think our demographic is African American, but also we have an Ethiopian and Korean makeup as well. Community's sort of changing from being, an older retirement community that was established originally back in the 1960s and is now turning over again where we're getting younger families again moving into the area. Something that you would really notice right away and you would be surprised given our close proximity to the city is the abundance of wildlife. Deer everywhere, bald eagles flying overhead from some of the bald eagle nests that are close by here. It's a wonderful place to live here in Fort Washington Estates with proximity to our nation's capital, but seeing the wildlife that we have here.
My name is Betsy Washington. I'm 62 years old and I live in Lake Barcroft. Lake Barcroft is in Fairfax County, but we're called Falls Church here, so it's near the Seven Corners area. We're located on two streams, Holmes Run and Tripps Run, and these streams were dammed to make Alexandria City Reservoir about 1913. And so this was used as the reservoir for Alexandria, and the wooded slopes and hillsides around the neighborhood were preserved for that purpose. And then they abandoned the reservoir in the 30s, I believe, and developers bought Lake Barcroft and developed it in the early 1950s. The lake is the heart of the community. So you come home from work and you're stressed and you've had a hectic day and you look out your window and your neighbors and friends are on the lake kayaking. They're in these battery-operated barges cruising around or swimming, and just all your cares go away. It's just a fabulous neighborhood. I moved in and wondered if it would ever get old or I would get tired of looking out the window at the lake, and it's never happened. And occasionally I have nightmares that I've moved to a bigger, fancier house with more amenities, and I wake up just longing for Lake Barcroft.
That was Betsy Washington in Lake Barcroft and Jay Krieger in Fort Washington Estates. If you'd like us to knock on your door so you can talk about your neighborhood, send an email to metro@wamu.org or send us a tweet. Our handle is @WAMUMetro. And to see a map of all the doors we've knocked on so far, visit our website, metroconnection.org. And that's Metro Connection for this week. We heard from WAMU's Jonathan Wilson, Martin DeCaro, Kavitha Cardoza, and Lauren Ober, along with reporter Matthew Schwartz. WAMU's Managing Editor of News is Memo Lyons. Metro Connections' Managing Producer is Tara Boyle. Lauren Landau is our Editorial Assistant. Our intern is Tyler Daniels. Lauren Landau and John Hines produce Door to Door. Thanks, as always, to the WAMU Engineering and Digital Media teams for their help with production and the Metro Connection website. Our theme song, Every Little Bit Hurts, and our door-to-door theme, No Girl, are from the album It Was Easy by Title Tracks and used with permission of the Ernest Jennings Record Company. We have information on all the music we use on metroconnection.org. Just click on a story and you'll find information about its accompanying song. You can also hear the entire show on our website by clicking This Week on Metro Connection or by subscribing to our podcast. We're also on iTunes, Stitcher, and the NPR News app. We hope you can join us next week when we'll honor the unsung heroes among us with a show we're calling Lifetime Achievement. We'll hear from a musician who's spent 88 years perfecting a rather surprising instrument. We'll meet an 80-year-old pioneer in the field of dance therapy, and it's lights, camera, action with a TV legend who's racked up thousands of interviews.
When you're preparing for interviews, I've heard that you don't really prepare. Yeah, talk about that.
Does that bother you? Because I know you're prepared all the time, right?
I'm Rebecca Shear, and thanks for listening to Metro Connection, a production of WAMU 88.5 News.